Welcome to The Vampire Squid, a podcast about increasing transparency and education in finance. This is Hyosan Lee, and welcome back to episode 29 of The Vampire Squid. I hope everyone had an awesome week, and today we're going to be finishing up part two of the interview with Jesse Felder. And I'm really excited for some of the upcoming episodes. I had some really awesome and interesting interview episodes, and I can't wait to share them with you guys. But for today's episode, we're going to finish up and we're going to be talking about how Jesse allocates his own personal portfolio. We talk about some of the ways that junior people can stand out and how Jesse actually stood out to get his initial job at Bear Stearns and how he's approached job interviews throughout his life. We also dive into some of his recommendations for books and materials that I'll also post onto the show notes in case any of you guys would like to download or purchase one of the books that Jesse recommends. But I hope that you guys enjoy this episode. And as always, if you have any questions, comments, suggestions, please feel free to email me at Alan, A-L-A-N, at thevampiresquid.com. And please find me also on Facebook as well, facebook.com/thevampiresquid. Okay, so the insider selling or buying is a good indicator for you guys. Talk about the beginning of a stock idea to the actual execution of the trade. What is the duration usually for one of those ideas, and what type of analysis do you guys typically run?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it's, the first part of that is idea generation. Where do ideas, come from? And I think for me, there's really two different ways. If it's an asset class, one question I just like to ask myself on a regular basis is, what's the most hated asset class on the planet? And I don't think I'm as good at this as Jim Rogers is. Somebody was telling me Jim Rogers was talking about farmland in North Korea. And I thought, now that is probably a hated asset class right there. So he's the best, I think, at thinking about that question. But, so I like to think of what's the most hated, because that's where the most opportunity is. And, I think over the last 12 months, most of that time, I would have said it's been gold has been the most hated asset class. But I think, I wrote a blog post a month or two ago that maybe 2 or 3 months ago, cash was the most hated asset class, at the time. Because I just think, you want to go wherever the most hated is, because that's where the greatest opportunity is. Whatever's the most loved is probably also the riskiest. And
so sort of a contrarian thinking.
Yeah. What's the most hated stock in the market? And then start thinking about, okay, if the consensus hates this stock, is the consensus right or wrong? That's that Howard Marks kind of second level thinking. Most of the time the consensus is right, but there are opportunities. That's how I found BP when the Deepwater Horizon oil spill was going on, and the spill was on CNN every day. It was pretty obvious what was the most hated stock in the market. It was, BP, and the stock was just in free fall. But the consensus was that BP is going to go out of business because the cleanup costs and, all this and the environmental, EPA fines and, whatever are going to put them out of business. Well, the worst case scenario at the time for BP, I think this was 2010 or 11. I can't remember exactly, but, worst case scenario for the estimate of what it was going to cost them was $30 billion. Well, if you just went and look at BP's cash flow statement, they're generating $30 billion a year in cash. So it's like, there's no chance this business is going to go bankrupt anytime soon. They could pay for all of the future liabilities in 1 year's worth of cash flow. Mm-hmm. So that was one opportunity. Then I also I go through the insider buying and selling just for looking for opportunities. And one I found recently that I was buying over the summer was, Western Refining, a small little, refining operation. I think they had two refineries, where the, CEO and the CFO and the chairman, executive chairman, were just buying tons of stock. over the summer. And they had had it, you know, this was also part of what I look at. They had a great track record in buying. So the last time they were buying before that was in, I think, 2011, 12. And, you know, the stock price went up 200% after they had bought it, you know, literally like 9 or 12 months after they had bought it. And so they had a really good, you know, track record of buying. So then I go, okay, wait, these guys are doing this again, and they have a really good track record. So let me start digging into the financials and seeing why are they buying? What's going on? What is the consensus towards this company? And what's the reality in this, you know, for this company?
Interesting. And how much do you allocate towards one of these trades, or how many stocks do you typically hold in your portfolio?
Oh man, that's. I really hesitate. I usually don't answer this question because I'm very aggressive. Just to give you an example, in January of this year, I had about 40% of my own, you know, personal money in just two gold mining stocks because they were trading at Ben Graham net, you know, prices, like essentially 50 cents on the dollar. You know, if you had liquidated these stocks, you would double your money, even at the lows. And so when I see that kind of opportunity, I allocate a bunch to it. But that's you know, the reason I hesitate to say that is because that's not the right thing for almost anybody else to do. You know, for me, you know, it's a very focused, concentrated, you know, style. And I'll maybe only own, you know, 5 to 8 stocks at a time.
Okay. Yeah, and I know how everyone says that you have to be extremely diversified and, you know, have at most 5% in one single name. But I mean, if you have a lot of conviction and confidence in certain stocks or indices, then it does make sense to allocate more towards that.
Yeah, and this is not, I should clarify too, this is not at all how we ran the hedge fund. The hedge fund was, you know, closer to 40, 50 names on the long side and, you know, 30, 40 on the short side, something, you know, along those lines, much more diversified. So.
Got it. Can you talk a little bit about what you think is, what you think makes a good hedge fund investor in terms of the psychology? You know, some of the common things that people say are, not being too emotional or having a higher tolerance of risk. What are some of the traits that you see, are good for investors?
Okay. So do you mean somebody, an investor in a hedge fund, somebody who's investing in a hedge fund or the actual hedge fund manager?
The actual hedge fund manager.
Okay. Cause I was going to say, you know, I read an interesting New York Times article profiling David Swensen, you know, the Yale endowment manager, and he is a hedge fund investor the way it should be, right? So he has a variety of guys. He really believes in their, you know, philosophies. But when one's not doing so well, he allocates more to that guy. And then the guy who's done really, really well, he'll take more. So he does it the opposite of what you normally, the way you normally see people invest in hedge funds, which is give more money to the guy who's doing well and take money away from the guy who's not doing so well. But yeah, so what makes a good hedge fund manager is really, you know, it's my favorite Ben Graham quote, which is another one I'm going to bungle. I think my friends know me. I'm famous for bungling quotes. But, you know, Ben Graham said, it's not your, the crowd that makes you right or wrong. It's, your data and your analysis. And so it's somebody who's able to focus on not what the market is telling them is the right or wrong thing to do. It's somebody who's able to pay attention to their process and their analysis and put that above all else. Because I've seen so many people, the markets push them to the point where they abandon their process, they abandon their own analysis. And so you have to have the confidence of your own, in your process and in your own, research ability. And, you know, during those trying times, you know, everybody's going to have them. I don't care who you are. You know, you have to be able to go back to your foundations, you know, go back to that, your analysis and say, is this still valid? And really kind of rely on that.
Mm-hmm. And maybe even at the more junior level, because I think you joined, you know, right after Bear Stearns. What about the analysts, and not necessarily the hedge fund manager? What about What are some good traits that you've seen in hedge fund analysts?
Well, I'll just say, you know, that the reason I got my job at Bear was because I actually had a, there was an alumnus who kind of helped me with my interview process there, and he gave me some great advice. He said, and this is probably the most popular question I get from people via email and Twitter and whatnot is, hey, how do I get a job in the industry, first of all, right? And, you know, so this gentleman kind of took me under his wing and he said, hey, look, here's how I got my first job. And this is, you know, when people do this, I hire them on the spot. He said, basically, go in there and, you know, flatter them. Don't, you know, don't kiss their ass, but tell them, you know, hey, I really want to do what you do. I admire you. I think, you know, I just really want to do this, and I will do anything it takes to help you be more successful at what you do. And when you approach it that way, it's hard for them to not see, you know, a younger version of themselves, right? And so, you know, I think approaching it that way, but then also just having something my dad taught me, a whatever it takes attitude. I will do whatever it takes to make this firm more successful. When you both communicate that, you know, in your job interview and to your boss or whatever, you know, nothing's going to hold you back. But if you communicate that and then actually act it, you know, actually do it. I will do whatever it takes to make this thing more successful in whatever, you know, however we're trying to accomplish that. And so that attitude, I think, is really, really rare. You know, there's a lot of people that think, oh yeah, I'm that way, but most people aren't. And most people actually don't even think about that. They just think about, oh, I have all these good skills and you should hire me because of my skills. No, no. Work ethic and your motivation and heart, you know, matters so much more than anything else.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And do you see that it's that's helpful in interviews when you just communicate that, or is it even more helpful when maybe the candidate has something that they've demonstrated dedication towards, you know, a club or a sport that they've done? Is that what you've seen with the more successful applicants?
Honestly, I haven't really seen any successful applicants. I only know from my own experience. I'll just tell you that I basically could have gotten any job that I wanted at Bear. And it was really hard to get a job there at the time. I could have gotten any job that I wanted and then worked wherever I wanted within that, that office because of my attitude. You know, it was just, and because of, you know, yeah, so, you know, I started out just running tickets at Bear, just literally running the tickets from the guys on the phones to the traders at the trade desk, and just moved my way up quicker than anybody else who was doing what I was doing. And it was just because they saw it as a job and I saw it as, you know, I can do this 10 times better than anybody else if I just try, you know, focus on that. I'm going to do this better than anybody else, and I'm going to anticipate what needs to be done. And, you know, and so I'm not trying to brag or, you know, and it may probably sound cliche, but I think, you know, just a lot of people think it should just happen to them and not, you know, they don't need to have this mindset of, you know, being proactive and, you know, just going for it and a whatever it takes attitude.
Okay. Especially nowadays when people are interviewing for jobs, it's a lot of people just focus on the technical aspects or their GPA, or their past work experience. But a lot of the intangibles that come off in an interview, aren't as emphasized as some of the previous things I mentioned.
Yeah. Well, and I really should clarify too. I don't want it to seem like it's just whatever it takes to make money or whatever it takes to, you know, just about greed, because, you know, for me, it was whatever it takes, so long as it's ethical. And I should make the point that that is one of the main reasons why I left the hedge fund in 2000 was for ethical reasons. And I couldn't, I'm willing to do whatever it takes to be successful within, you know, the ethical boundaries. And I think that also is, not as common as it should be on Wall Street.
Mm-hmm. And are you able to expand on that?
Yeah. Well, there were two different things that were going on. One was we had strayed from our mandate. You know, we were trying to find cheap stocks, you know, with good insider buying and good prospects. And my partner in the firm had decided that, you know, and this happened to so many people. Stan Druckenmiller has a famous, you know, story about it where he, you know, in March of 2000, he flipped and he went from being short some of these .com names to buying them. And, you know, we sort of did a similar thing where my partner, you know, I'm kind of coming up with cheap stocks like Ball Corp and Washington Mutual, you know, was trading 5x earnings at the time. And it was just a basic thrift back then, not the financial Frankenstein that it turned into years later. But my partner wanted to start buying, you know, the Red Hats and all the, you know, Netscapes and the high flyers. And I said, look, that, you know, we started getting into kind of shouting matches and stuff, on a daily basis over this because I felt like that wasn't within our mandate. Momentum and growth, you know, especially highly overvalued stocks that were just running on momentum were not part of our mandate. And so that was part of it. But, the other part was, you know, from a business standpoint as well, you know, he wanted to push the boundaries of what was, you know, legal within the securities industry. And I said, look, I don't even want to get close to the legal boundaries. I'm much more interested in what's ethical. And I don't think some of these ideas that he had were ethical. And so that's where I said, okay, we got to part ways.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I think that's helpful. And, especially within finance, the perception in the media and how it's portrayed is a lot of times about greed and unethicalness. And, I think it's important to keep in mind that you should hold a high sense of ethics at all times.
And there are a lot of really good people in this business. I think, you know, sometimes we are, you know, the industry is kind of pegged as being, you know, this industry is about making money. So it is about greed to a certain extent. But there are a lot of good people in the industry. I don't, you know, want to give any other impression, but that was my experience.
Okay. And, you know, for the students that are interested in getting into hedge funds or learning more about investing, do you have any recommendations in terms of books, blogs, websites to follow?
Oh man. Yeah. Well, I've mentioned a couple of books. The Most Important Thing from Howard Marks is fantastic. I like The Tao of Capital. That's one I read recently, Mark Spitznagel. It's about, applying Austrian economics to the markets. The Market Wizards series. Market Wizards and New Market Wizards are my, you know, two of my favorites. There's a great, it's a little bit longer book, written by David Einhorn about one short sale, saga that he had over a long period of time called Fooling Some of the People All of the Time. And that's a lesson in short selling in itself in that one 500 page book. Just fascinating. So, but yeah, I've had people ask me, you know, put a resources page on your website because, you know, I do quote different books on a regular basis, but I don't have like a definitive list of my favorite reads. Reminiscences of a Stock Operator, you know, Edwin Lefebvre wrote the fictionalized biography of Jesse Livermore. That's a really good one. I also like the new real biography. It's called Jesse Livermore Boy Plunger, which is that's the definitive biography that just came out.
Okay. And what are your current views on the market?
Yeah, well, I've been for a couple of years now, I've been very cautious, if not bearish, on the broad stock market. I think that when you look at, you know, things like there's a variety of different valuation measures you can look at, right? And based on whichever one you want to look at, you can be bullish or bearish. The most valuable measures I look at suggest that the stock market is extremely overvalued as much as it was almost at any time in history. The Buffett measure, which is market cap to GDP, is extremely high, kind of a price to sales ratio. Then if you look at median price to sales ratio of the stock market, it's never been higher than it is today. So the median stock based, price to sales has never been higher. So, I think there's, the risk reward is skewed to the downside for the broad stock market. I think that the, this recent Trump rally, is especially interesting, because there's been a lot of euphoria and optimism towards parts of what he's talked about. But I think it's also, over optimistic in a lot of ways and kind of disregarding a lot of the hurdles he's going to face and then also the potential ways that these policies could backfire. So, and the main thing I'm looking at right now is interest rates are going higher and over the last 6-7 years, the argument for, high equity valuations are justified by low interest rates. And I haven't heard anyone say that in the last couple of weeks as interest rates have gone soaring higher, the dollar breaking up to new highs, new 13-year highs. That's a major headwind for earnings, of multinationals. And a lot of times that can create a crisis somewhere around the world. So there's a potential crisis brewing in China I'm paying, close attention to. So I think, risk assets are especially risky today. And, I think, I still think in some respects, gold has come down and has become a little more attractive again. I think in a lot of respects, though, cash is still the most hated asset class on the planet. And it's going to make a lot of sense to have some dry powder over the next few years.
So you're saying if you still had that short only fund, now would be a good time to make some investments?
I think so. I talked to a couple short sellers and they say, this is the best environment the last year or two, the best environment they've seen in a long, long time. You have stocks like Valeant, pharmaceuticals blowing up and, lots of other opportunities to find those types of things. The market isn't as uniform as it has been, for a lot of the rally since 2009.
This is very informative and helpful chat, Jesse. If people want to get in contact with you, what are some of the best ways they can do that?
I'm pretty active on Twitter. It's at Jesse Felder. And then also, my blog is at, thefelderreport.com. And I try and write something there once or twice a week. And it's got an email link on that website. So happy to field any, messages through Twitter or, through the website. And, thanks for having me on. I've enjoyed it.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Jesse.